Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Stefano Guandolini, founder and medical director of the University of Chicago's Celiac Disease Center, about celiac disease then and now.
Really looking forward to this conversation, Christy. And I think actually more people in my family are interested in this question in the show than almost any I've done. It seems like there's so many people doing gluten-free diets, and is that really even needed or wise?
Right. But first, we have some research that matters, Adam. We're going to talk about a new device to pace your appetite.
We'll talk about is it wise,
but
it's available. We'll talk about the relationship between work and family conflict and sleep.
And about TV alcohol ads being tied to problem drinking for teens.
And finally, how old do you feel? And does that relate to how old you are? And does that relate to your health at some point in time? Interesting questions. Let's talk about the very first one, which is about a new device for weight loss.
Yeah. So before we launch into this, we should acknowledge that obesity is a significant problem in our country. We have all kinds of different ways of approaching it, but we need to continue to make headway into this problem and provide help for people. And this is one attempt to do that. This is the first FDA-approved obesity device released since 2007, and it's a device that you put into your stomach, or a surgeon does, that blocks hunger signals to go from the stomach to the brain or the brain to the stomach.
And it's only indicated for those who haven't been able to lose weight with a weight loss program and who have a body mass index, or the BMI, of 35 to 45, which would be very obese to morbidly obese, and also have a obesity-related condition such as diabetes. So it's a subset of those who could benefit from this device that's called Maestro. Interesting
so
name.
The idea is that it can block signals along the nerves that connect the brain to the stomach, and so it can reduce your feeling of hunger and promote earlier feelings of fullness, which would then help people with obesity decrease the number of calories they take in.
And in some of the clinical trials, people who had this device lost about 8.5% of their excess weight compared to people who had a sham device implanted, which I don't even want to think about the sham device implanted, but you have to prove it works. The FDA wanted to see it to be 10%, so they can continue to gather post-approval marketing studies. And this device might compare to other sorts of surgical approaches, because there are surgical approaches out there. This device is expensive.
Mm-hmm. It costs about $15,000. $15,000. And at this point, you can't just like go buy it out in the store, and most insurances probably will not pay for it right at this moment. But if it's worth talking to your doctor about and looking to see if there's a surgeon nearby who might be starting to do this, I wouldn't personally advise my patients to rush into it without having gone through some of the more proven approaches first. But
I kind of agree with that, Christy. I tend to be a late adopter of technology.
The more
invasive technologies, I want to kind of let it be in the marketplace, actually, not just approved, but in the marketplace, and see how it's actually being used in the marketplace, and see about the safety over several years. But it is something that you could talk with surgeons about, bariatric surgeons, and we wanted to talk about it. Let's talk about our very next research that matters, Christy, about work, family, conflict, and sleep.
Yeah. So this was a study of sorts where they looked at changing the workplace culture to see if that had an influence on the amount of sleep that their employees obtain and their perception of sleep over time.
Yeah, this was actually not necessarily a randomized control trial, that gold standard, but it was a study where they randomly selected both managers and employees at a business, and a three-month program that focused on trained for the managers to be supportive of employees' family life and demands, and discussion groups and role-playing and games, it sounds fun. And then they looked at a year later, did this improve some outcomes that are important to people, like sleep?
Yeah. So, I mean, by focusing on trying to lessen work-family conflict through the intervention, then they followed 12 months later and found that the program participants slept an hour more each week and were more likely to feel they had sufficient sleep than those who weren't in the program. This was published in Sleep Health, a journal we didn't find out information about a control group, so it's hard to know if, you know, to prove that this particular program is definitely going to help everyone or helps them more than people in another group. But it's positive and doesn't have a whole lot of downside.
No, I don't think so. I think trying to help resolve work family, and so instead of thinking of us that we're kind of schizophrenically divided from one and the other,
right,
in our lives, that we're together in our mental
work
and physical health.
Yeah.
Important.
Yeah, yep. Very important.
Let's talk about our very next research that matters, about perhaps being united about what we think about this next research study about alcohol advertising and problem drinking for teens.
So this was a study linking the number of TV ads for alcohol that a teen views and their risk for problem drinking.
Yeah, this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal Pediatrics and involved 1,600 youth ages 15 to 23 who were surveyed in 2011 and then in 2013. And they were looking at how familiar they were with alcohol advertisements, which are all over the TV, similar to how tobacco advertisements used to be on television, and then different outcomes subsequently of problem drinking with these adolescents and young adults.
And so the alcohol ads on TV were seen by about 23% of those in the younger ages, 15 to 17, about 23% in the next group, and more than that in ages 21 to 23 at 26%. So pretty common that they saw them. And there was a relationship, and the more receptive teens were to the alcohol ads on TV, the more likely they were to start drinking or to progress from drinking to binge drinking or hazardous drinking. So the more they sort of paid attention to them or receptive they were, the more likely they were to be drinking more.
And this research really does begin to suggest, along with many other studies previously on this topic, that alcohol advertising is a cause of youth drinking. That's not really all that shocking, frankly. We did
you
the research, and
tobacco.
I did some of my very first research studies ever had to do with the role of tobacco advertising in youth smoking. And at the time, for the first decade after these studies came out, there was the tobacco industry said, no, these didn't relate. These were just associations. But it turned out more and more research, and now it's well established that the marketing of tobacco products is a causal factor, not the only causal factor, but a major causal factor in youth smoking. And if you eliminated all the exposure to the marketing, rates would go down. It's clear in my mind that this is in the same direction and is likely to be a factor. And it's worth talking about media literacy with our children about alcohol advertising.
Well, I think that's the big thing. It just makes it look like drinking is like part of family community and how you get friends and how you have fun. And it's important to have those conversations at home if you have the TV on about what the marketing strategy is, and to really talk about what that's about. And
because binge drinking and alcohol-related motor vehicle accidents and alcohol-related trauma is a huge public health problem. Let's talk about our very last research that matters, a little lighter. It's about how young you feel at heart. And this was a research letter that was in the Journal of American Medical Association's Internal Medicine Journal.
Yeah, so they looked at about 6,500 people with an average age of 66 years of age who reported how did they feel their age? Did they feel a little bit less? How old did they feel? And then how old actually were they? And then they followed them 8 years out to see what their outcomes were.
And those who said they felt younger than their stated age significantly reported later on with better health outcomes when they got older compared to those who said that they felt kind of older or the same age as what they were, you know, suggesting there is some validity for people who say they feel younger than their stated age, that they probably are in better health.
Yeah, well, it's hard to know. Or does it have to do with the attitude? I mean, a little over 14% of those who felt younger than their years had died during the follow-up period, compared with 24% of people who reported feeling older than their years had died. So if you felt older than your age, you were more likely to die during that study period. But it's hard to know. Is that because they were less healthy, or is that Is that some sort of self-fulfilling prophecy that if you feel old, you're less likely to do things and get out? And I don't know.
You feel younger? Do you feel younger than your stated age today, Chris? Or should I not go there? That's probably I would say
the answer is I feel older than my stated age today, but I better get a handle on that.
Yeah, and I'm not going to ask someone else what they think how old yes. I look. It used to be when I went to the state fair, I would always go up there and they would say, you know, they would always guess like, you know, 5 to 10 years younger than my age. And then when I went up there, like 1 year, only 1 year had passed, I went up there and they like guessed 15 years older than my age. I'm like, I still won the prize.
Uh-huh. But this isn't about how you look. It's about how you feel.
Yeah, it's a little bit of each.
To get to feeling young again.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We've had a good chance to talk about how old you think you are.
And a little bit about TV alcohol ads being tied to problem drinking for teenagers. Talk to your children.
About really not having conflicts between work and family stress life, but really dealing with both of them in both situations.
And about this new approved appetite pacemaker device that needs further study, but may be a good thing down the road.
That'll conclude the Research That Matters portions of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Stefano Guandolini, founder and medical director of the University of Chicago Celiac Disease Center, about celiac disease then and now. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's #2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Stefano Guandolini, founder and medical director of the University of Chicago Celiac Disease Center, about celiac disease then and now.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Guandolini.
Well, thank you for having me there, Christy and Adam.
Yes, how did you become so passionate about digestive diseases? What sparked your interest in digestion and in celiac disease in particular?
Well, when I became a pediatrician, it was a time that was in Italy in the early 70s where gastrointestinal diseases were extremely common. And so it was kind of a natural. In addition, there was a pioneer in Europe on the study of celiac disease, Professor Auricchio, who is now retired and still works, however, very actively in research. And so it was, you know, when you have a mentor, a supervisor that's inspiring, it really makes all the difference. So I got really involved in this, and I love the pediatric gastroenterology, and this has been my area since then.
Well, we're thrilled that you've chosen this. And I must say, when I was in medical school, you know, I heard about celiac disease in residency. I heard about it, but it was like one of those things that I thought, oh, you know, I won't need to know too much about it. And oh, boy, was I wrong. Tell us, define for our listeners, what is celiac disease and why are we having a show on it?
Well, celiac disease is an autoimmune condition which is triggered by the ingestion of gluten, a protein contained in wheat, barley, and rye, in individuals who are genetically susceptible for this condition. It had been actually widely known in Europe for many years, and for some reason, there was this misunderstanding that in North America, celiac disease was a rare condition. So I'm not surprised to hear that you just thought this was not that common, because this was the teaching. Even in as late as the year 2000, the Nelson Textbook of Pediatrics, which, as you probably know, is the kind of the main source of information for pediatricians around the world, was quoting in an article written by an American author, was quoting celiac disease as being as prevalent as 1 in 10,000 individuals, and being actually diminishing and vanishing from the face of the earth, which, of course, was totally wrong. Celiac disease causes your intestinal absorptive surface to be severely damaged, and hence the absorption of nutrients is compromised. This happens to different degrees in different individuals, and most commonly the manifestations are gastrointestinal. In fact, we still use the term typical celiac disease when referring to gastrointestinal manifestations such as chronic diarrhea accompanied by abdominal pain, abdominal distension in children, failure to thrive. However, with time, we have come to realize that celiac disease goes well beyond the intestine and it causes manifestations as disparate as dental enamel hypoplasia, or headaches, or recurrent seizures, or short stature, or anemia. So the list is quite long. And unless one is fully aware that celiac disease can present with such a protean manifestation, then the suspicion is not triggering the test. And my thinking is that for some reason in North America, celiac already from decades probably would present itself with mostly extra-intestinal manifestations. So it was below the radar of the doctors who were thinking celiac is just a disease affecting the 2-3-year-old and causing chronic diarrhea and failure to thrive. And for this reason, they kind of were late in jumping on the bandwagon, if you wish, of searching for celiac disease.
Well, it's interesting, the mixed messages, because on the one hand, you've got certain people saying, oh, this is rare and not very common at all. And then there's a lot of publicity and a lot of sort of fad diets that are gluten-free, and everybody wants everyone's concerned about celiac disease and diets that might help digestion. And there's a lot of misconception from the public, too. So you mentioned some of the most common signs being diarrhea and pain and maybe failure to thrive in children. But what really should prompt someone to get tested and go to the doctor, and what does that look like?
Well, Christy, this is an interesting question because it gives me, first of all, the opportunity to make a clear statement, which I really think is important. Never, never, never begin a gluten-free diet without first being tested for celiac disease. The reason being that if you do that, then for us as physicians, it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to end up with a diagnosis.
Yes.
Because, of course, with celiac disease, the ingestion of gluten maintains production of autoantibodies, which are easily detectable in the blood. There is a specific test, as you know, which is considered extremely sensitive and specific for celiac disease, which is the tissue transglutaminase test, or TTG. And within weeks of beginning a diet, these antibodies begin to disappear to the point that we estimate between 2 and 3 months after the diet, the chances that somebody who had positive antibodies and could have been diagnosed, the chances of having the antibodies still positive are almost gone. And so it becomes hard to make a diagnosis.
So if they just stop eating gluten and say, okay, well, I feel better now, so I must have this diagnosis and go to the doctor, the doctor's going to say, well, I need you to go back to eating it again.
They would say no. So that's the problem. I had actually this very morning, I have a beautiful 16-year-old girl who, because the father thought he had celiac and went gluten-free, and she had some minor, abdominal discomfort, some bloating. She also went gluten-free 3 weeks ago, and she now feels much better and is asking me what to do. And, it's hard to unravel the problem and get to the bottom of it. So never start the diet. Now, who should be thinking of having celiac disease? As I said before, the list of symptoms is quite long, and they encompass all different organs and systems. So it's not a very easy task, but we know quite well which are the categories of patients, of individuals rather, who should be tested for celiac. So first of all, those who have the classical gastrointestinal symptoms that I mentioned earlier, and I want to add also constipation. This may seem counterintuitive, but even children and teenagers who only have constipation as the only symptoms may have celiac disease. So those who have those symptoms and the failure to thrive, etc. Then if you look at the extra-intestinal manifestations, I would like to think that those who have fatigue, or chronic or recurrent headaches, recurrent mouth ulcers, or unexplained transaminitis, as people refer to it. So when your liver enzymes, AST and ALT, are elevated, usually 2, 3, 4-fold from normal, with no understandable reason, these patients have a high chance of having celiac disease. And then short stature in kids or delayed puberty are also signs that need to be raising an alarm of celiac disease. And I mentioned before anemia. Now, iron deficient anemia is extremely common in adults, and it has been considered, it is considered the most common presentation of celiac disease in the adult population. Yet, when you there was a survey recently on hematologists that were asked, if you see a patient with oral iron deficient anemia who is resistant to iron supplement, would you test for celiac disease? And 84% of the respondents say no, there is no need. So clearly, there is still a large educational unmet need for that. So anemia, even recurrent seizures when they have no obvious explanation, although that's not a very common presentation of celiac disease, but it can be. Headaches certainly are a common problem encountered, especially in young teenagers with celiac disease.
Dr. Guadagnini, we're going to need to take a short break. But when I come back, I want to pick up on this question of the categories you just have given actually describe about 75% of my patients as a primary care physician. And so it's going to get us into this question about testing and who can be tested and what are we doing to develop tests that perhaps are more consumer-friendly and in the consumer realm versus the doctor's realm to facilitate perhaps diagnosis and treatment of those who are undertreated. So we're going to take a short break. Hold on. And we're going to be right back with our expert, Dr. Stefano Guadagnini, founder and medical director of University of Chicago Celiac Disease Center, talking about celiac disease then and now. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Stefano Guadagnini, founder and medical director of the University of Chicago Celiac Disease Center, about celiac disease then and now. And right before the break, Dr. Guadagnini, you were really laying out that the manifestations are very large and that this underdiagnosis is likely real because a lot of times providers, maybe patients, we don't think about it enough. Help us understand the testing. Is it moving in the direction that this test becomes less expensive and more available, or is it still pretty expensive and not so available?
Well, in terms of the testing, I think we have witnessed an important development and improvement of the availability of the of correct testing. I don't want to go back to the history of how this test came to be developed and how we, you know, went from a situation in which they were really unreliable to a situation in which they're actually quite good. But the long and the short is now that we have this blood test called TTG, or tissue transglutaminase, IgA test, which is really very sensitive. The sensitivity is considered to be 97-98%. So that means only 2 or 3% of the celiac patients would be missed by a test. So if the test is negative, you can pretty much, and you are eating gluten, that's important to stress, then the test being negative, you can pretty much rule out celiac disease. The specificity of the test is good. It's about, again, 96-97%. So if the test is clearly positive, then your chances of having celiac disease are 96-97%, but not 100%. And that gives me also the opportunity to tell that positive tests, especially at the low titers, are not really enough to make a diagnosis. So people and all of our colleagues should actually be careful about running, you know, going quickly to make a diagnosis of celiac disease only based on a positive test.
How expensive is this test?
Pardon?
How expensive is the test, and is it becoming more available for home diagnostic testing?
Yeah, well, it depends on which laboratory runs it, of course, so there is a variation of prices, but it's going to be around $150 to $200. That's the average cost of this test.
Not too bad.
No, it's not too bad, Adam. It's actually worth it, because if you consider the diagnostic yield, you know, it's really important to do this.
So, Doctor...
Yes, Chrissy.
Well, I wanted to move into once someone's had a diagnosis and they've received this diagnosis, they need to be on a gluten-free diet. But you talked about other manifestations in the body. Are there other things they need to do or ways that they need to follow with doctors to look out for those other those other manifestations in the body?
Well, not really, because once the diagnosis is made, and as I said, the blood test is an excellent screening test, but in most cases the diagnosis would have to be confirmed by a gastroenterologist that would obtain biopsies from the duodenal mucosa and make a diagnosis with them during an endoscopy.
Right.
Once the diagnosis is confirmed, it is expected that most of the manifestations of celiac disease, whether intestinal or extraintestinal, would regress. We are actually right now conducting a study in our database of patients here at the University of Chicago Celiac Disease Center. We have about roughly 1,200 patients with celiac disease between kids and adults. And we are trying to address the question whether or not the extraintestinal manifestations are also prone to be responsive to the gluten-free diet, as we know the gastrointestinal are. But in general, the expectation is that, and this is a good thing about this condition, almost everything basically goes back to normal once a strict gluten-free diet is instituted.
That's good news.
So if you've mentioned about children, but I'm thinking about one of the first cases I ever saw of celiac was actually in someone who was in their late 60s. And you just mentioned adults. So this is clearly happens in adults. Why does it happen in adults late in life? What happens?
Well, this is a very interesting question, which we don't really know the answer to. But anecdotally, the oldest person ever diagnosed with celiac disease was a woman of 101. So you can imagine, you know, she basically lived for one century without having problems with wheat, and then all of a sudden developed this. So we think that besides the genetic susceptibility, which is now pretty well known, there are environmental factors that trigger celiac disease. Of course, the only necessary one is gluten. I mean, if you were born in the 15th century China, probably only had rice available as the only cereal, so there is no chance you would develop celiac. So gluten is, of course, necessary. But there are a number of other factors which seem to create the perfect storm that leads to the development of celiac disease. Among them, a central role appears to be played by the microbiota. As you know, we have trillions of bacteria happily living in our colon mostly, and they are instrumental in maintaining our health, our immune system healthy, etc. And when something goes awry, for instance, use of antibiotics or recurrent infections, then you create a situation of imbalance. And if you are genetically disposed, that's a point when you can develop celiac disease. So it's a combination of environmental factors, sometimes summing up to each other, that leads to the development of this condition at any age. That's the extent of what we know today, but still there is clearly more investigations need to understand.
Well,
we aren't even really sure if the celiac disease of the kids is the same celiac disease that adults experience.
Well, that leads us to another question. You've been very involved and a very successful researcher and have developed this University of Chicago Celiac Disease Center. It's been very successful, but tell us a bit about what your goals are with that center and the benefits of having such a center.
Well, our center is incredibly ambitious, Christy, so we are really playing on many different tables. One of them is research. Actually, this is one of the most important things. So we have a group of really outstanding, world-class researchers that work in the area of gut immunology and are trying, as the main aim on this, to actually find a cure for celiac disease. Currently, this condition is incurable. I mean, it can be treated with the diet, but still many patients, even those who follow strictly a diet, may not have a 100% resolution of their symptoms. So having a cure for this condition is paramount. And again, we have stellar investigators who are working to develop what we call a therapeutic vaccine for this condition, so a real cure.
Wow.
I'm confident within, I want to say, 10 to 12 years, something like that, we might get there. We also are incredibly active in education because, as we briefly mentioned before, there is still a need to spread the word about celiac disease, make people understand what makes it unique and when to request the test and how to follow patients. So we are very dedicated to educational activities. One of them is actually coming up at the end of March when our troop, our team, will travel to North Carolina, as a matter of fact, Wilmington specifically. Yeah, we'll be there to export one of our successful programs, which is a celiac disease preceptorship days. So every year in December at the University of Chicago, we host about 20 between physicians and nurse practitioners who are interested in celiac disease, and we have two days of full immersion. They present their cases interactively with us. We give lectures. We see patients with them, etc. So it's a very intense, hands-on kind of course. And people over there that have been here like it so much that they've invited us to actually replicate the same thing over there. So this is an experiment coming up at the end of March in Wilmington.
We love the North Carolina Chicago connection here, except for the weather. But I guess we just have about a minute left, and I wonder if you could tell me two things. One is, what's the biggest myth that you think needs to be dispelled? And then what's your hope for the future of this disease and its treatment?
All right. So in terms of myths, I would say the most important myth is that this is it's not a food allergic condition and it's not a fad. People who actually have celiac disease need to follow a strict gluten-free diet. And unfortunately, the fact that this has now become a healthier diet in the eyes of many people, and many people have embraced this diet, on one hand, is beneficial because it has allowed more products to be available, but on the other hand, has created a situation whereby people think that people who are gluten-free really don't need the diet. And so that's a myth. You know, celiac disease is a serious condition. It's an autoimmune condition. Needs to be respected, so to speak. The hope for the future is actually, Adam, a lot on our therapeutic vaccine. I know I seem to be bragging too much about our center and what we do, but we really are working very hard with this focus on being the center in the world that finds a cure for celiac disease. And once this is achieved, it will be an enormous advantage if you consider 1% of the population is affected by celiac disease. The other hope, let me put a second point, is actually to have everyone diagnosed with celiac disease. Unfortunately, of the 3 million Americans that we estimate are having celiac disease as we speak, only about 400,000 are diagnosed. So about 85% of the celiac patients in this country right now do not know that they have celiac. So doctors need to be more listening to their patients, need to have this condition more in mind, need to be requesting more often tests.
That's
so that
a
our
goal.
Diagnosis rate increases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you have a right to brag, and when you get a Nobel Prize, you got to remember that you got to come back on our show first.
That's right. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, Christine. Adam, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
We've been talking with Dr. Stefano Guandolini, founder and medical director of the University of Chicago's Celiac Disease Center, about celiac disease then and now. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about the questions you've sent us for your health and your concerns.
And if you'd like to send us something on an upcoming show, please send a comment or question to yourhealth@unc.edu. If you'd like to ask a guest producer, Jenica Siddle, to read us our very first House Call question. Jenica?
I went to my doctor with a staph infection in my finger, which I acquired from biting my fingernail. My finger has slightly improved, but I noticed it started to pus a very tiny bit. Is this normal, or do I need to revisit my doctor?
Pus a very tiny bit. That's hard to know without seeing a picture of it.
Yeah, but I got this visualization in my head, Christy, that, you know, it was hurting, and then you saw the doctor, and now the pus is there. And that actually could be a good thing, right? Because it could mean that it's about to work itself out and burst, and pus needs to come out. That is an answer.
If you have a pocket of pus like that, usually what the doctor would do is lance it in some way to let that pus sort of come out and release itself. So doing some warm soaks can sometimes help just to let it kind of get the blood flowing, and maybe it'll just sort of burst and heal up. But certainly if it's getting bigger, if you're getting redness around that site or any redness going up your finger, you need to get an antibiotic and see your doctor.
And don't stick that safety pin in there.
No.
Think that you can do it yourself. Go see the doctor again and maybe have it done with under more sterile conditions. And don't bite your fingernails. We got to work on that too.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, I can't talk about that, but because I do bite my fingernails sometimes, but I'm getting better.
Good.
All right. There we go. Confession.
Jenica, what's our very next house call?
My daughter is 6 years old, and for the last 2 days, she says it hurts when she pee-pees. Can little girls get bladder infections?
Oh, yes. Little girls can get bladder infections, and they're more likely to get bladder infections than boys are, although it is possible with boys. So, sure, if it hurts when she goes to the bathroom, I mean, it can also be from if she was riding a bike and had some trauma to her bottom or had irritated it in some way. So it may not be a bladder infection, but certainly little girls can get that, and if it's continuing to hurt, I would get that checked out.
Yeah, I'd make an appointment and to be seen because it's really hard to know here. Mm-hmm. I've seen little girls that have been in bubble bath and they get a little external irritation around the external genitalia, and that can be irritating and mimic a bladder infection. A lot of that will go away. So if this is continuing, it needs to be looked at.
Sure, sure. That's good advice. Okay, thank you for your question. Let's take our next house call question.
I was feeling really overwhelmed and crying a lot. I was yelling at my daughter and just having a hard time dealing with everything. I finally went to my doctor who started me on a medicine called Lexapro. I'm writing just to let people know that if you're depressed or anxious, it is totally worth trying medicine. I feel so much better. I don't think I'll ever go off of it. I don't want to feel that way again if I can help it.
Well, thank you for sharing your story with us and with our listeners. You know, I hear this a lot, that people who, especially sometimes people don't want to start on a medicine for lots of good reasons, but in certain situations, it really can make a difference. In this case, you're talking Lexapro is escitalopram, which is one of those SSRI medications we talk about a lot on the show, Adam, and it can make a difference if you have depression or anxiety.
I think that this would be a great opportunity for us to ask our health science librarians to maybe mm-hmm. post some information about SSRIs, because they're a class of medications mm-hmm. there. This is one, and there's not necessarily one is necessarily better than the other. But one other thing here is that there's a piece of this that also needs to maybe looked at, which is, you know, is there anything underlying the yelling, and is there anything that's precipitating the depression, or is there other things that are happening here? And this is something that you really need to also talk with your doctor about or a mental health professional, because there could be substance use, there could be genetic issues, there could mm-hmm. be other things that the medicine is one part, an important part, but not the only part.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jenica, what's our very last house call?
I fell down the stairs and got a huge hematoma on my bottom. Is it okay to keep exercising, or am I supposed to wait for it to completely go away?
A hematoma. We should probably explain that to our listeners. That is when, if you fall and you get kind of like a bruise that makes a big welt. It's sort of like where the blood walls off a little bit and makes a little pocket of blood. And sometimes, like if you had one on your shin or if you had one over like a bony area, it can look really prominent and bad. And sometimes if it's like on your thigh, it might not look as bad as it actually is, where you can get a big pocket of blood.
Yeah, and it can be more often painful than it is dangerous here, and it'd be unlikely. It's not like these are the types of blood collections that are going to cause a blood clot to the brain, mm-hmm. but people do have, when they fall, sometimes hit their head, they get a subdural hematoma, a blood collection under the brain. That could be serious. And I guess the real question is, what happened to led you to fall? You know, that's something that maybe we wouldn't necessarily think about, but we should, because maybe we don't want to fall again going downstairs. Did you have the right handrail? Did you have the right shoes? Was it wet? What was going on?
But to answer your question about exercise, if you feel up to exercising, it may be a little bit sore, but if there's nothing else going on, then it's totally fine to get that blood moving and go ahead and get back to your exercise if you feel up to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that'll conclude our house calls for today, and we want to thank you for joining us for your health. We hope the issues that we've addressed are important to you and your health, and you can send us your own questions or stories at yourhealth@unc.edu and visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Stefano Guandolini. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.